Welcome to another episode of Let Go and Lead, where we discuss the new realities of leadership with pioneers, provocateurs, and passionate leadership champions. My guest today is Jeppe Hansgaard, CEO of Danish firm Innovizer. Innovizer is a leader in mapping and activating the informal networks that lie beneath and often operate independently of the formal hierarchies we capture in org charts and reporting lines. Jeppe's numerous real-life examples of organizational network analysis highlight the enormous power and potential to galvanize your organization's informal network to accelerate real, authentic change. This is an episode you won't want to miss. So get comfortable and get ready to let go and lead. Jeppe, thank you so much for joining us. Very excited to hear about all of your work with organizational network mapping. It just sounds fascinating. And before we get into that, I'd just love to hear a little bit about your career journey and what got you to this point.
Yes, that's a good question. So as a very young gentleman, the first thing I actually entered in my professional career was the field of supply chain optimization. So how you could get goods from Asia, like from stores, like in H&M, if you're familiar with H&M or Zara or other companies, right? How would they get their T-shirts, their trousers, and whatever from Asia into the stores in Europe and actually also in North America? And doing that is basically just a big supply chain optimization work where you actually go down to the small penny to optimize whatever you can. So that's where I started. Looking at that as a big network, I then moved into change management consulting, which is a totally different field, right? I started to look at the organization as a network of people, as people being connected to each other, influencing each other, and then suddenly I got introduced to a method called organization network analysis, and from there on, that's where Innovizer started. I built a business around organization network analysis that is now a global company.
And why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what that is?
Network analysis is really about understanding how people are connecting to each other. You can visualize it. Visualizations make sense when you're about 200 people or so, but when it gets above that, you have to get down to the real data underneath and analyzing. But what it can tell you is, for example, who is it that has the influence in an organization? Who is it that people reach out to if they want to innovate? Who is it that people trust? Or who is it that makes the decisions, etc.? So you can look at that from an individual level, but also at an aggregated level. So you can look at it from a team perspective, for example, and we know that the more coherent teams are in the networks, the better performing they are. Or you can look at an organizational level. And sometimes you can actually look across organizations. So how are organizations connecting to each other? Then we call it ecosystems. So there are many different ways of actually viewing an organization and networks that they have. And you have different networks inside an organization. Let me give you an example. If I ask you who gives you energy in your daily work life, which is a question we sometimes ask people, then there's only one person that can actually respond to that question, and that is you. So we ask people questions, very simple questions like that one. We prompt them for their first thoughts, and then within maybe 5 minutes or so, then we have collected the data we need to come up with the recommendations and actions that we need to get to.
Are you able to do that at a really large scale?
Yeah, good question again. We have done it up to 200,000 people.
Yeah, well, I know that, you know, there's a big difference between the formal and the informal networks in an organization. And so many people focus on the formal, which in my experience work half as well as the informal network does.
Yes, and I agree. I mean, in fact, what we see is that in our analysis, that the overlap between where the work is done and in the formal setting, I mean, I think it's about maybe on average about 20% of the work that is done inside the formal structures in the org chart. So if you think about those boxes, right, how much of the work is really taking place inside those boxes compared to how much is taking place because people interact with people outside their own box? And every single time you kind of do something outside, that's where the informal networks take over, because it's not defined typically by a process or whatever. It's actually more defined by your own maybe experience, your own habits, or maybe your knowledge of who should you go to if you want to get this problem solved.
I often think of people talking about the workarounds, where that seems to all happen in the informal networks.
That is exactly where it happens, right? When you have something to solve and it's a bit complex, you ask your colleague, who should I go to get this solved? And then your colleague sits there and with all of the experience they have in the organization, they say, oh, you need to go to this person to get this solved, right? So you do that rather than anything else, really. You ask for help.
What is the 3% rule? I saw you talk about that a lot in your materials.
Yes. So the 3% rule is something we stumbled upon, basically. A lot of times we've had this issue that that companies ask us to find out what group of people should they engage to have the maximum impact for a change program. What we did was that we said, okay, if we want to have maximum impact in an organization, we need to reach all the small cliques and communities and tribes around the organization. We cannot only focus on the headquarters, for example, right? We need to find around the world where people have influence, right? So we said we need to find the most influential people. Who has influence? Well, characteristics of influence are, for example, that you are sympathetic, that you are competent, and that you're trustworthy. So if we have these three things, right, and we find out, okay, so who is it that people consider that? And like I said before, it's only one person that can really tell who you find sympathetic, competent, trustworthy, and that's you. I mean, your colleague might find another person trustworthy, right? And when we take all of that data and bring it together, we can build and draw a network of how people are connecting across the entire organization. The 3% rule is then making sure that we take people from all around the organization. And then we see, so when is it that it doesn't make sense actually to add more people to a group? Where is it that we will not have impact on more people in the organization? And somehow, that's what 15 years of experience has showed us, it's always around 3% that shape the commitment of and the perceptions of about 90% of their colleagues. Sometimes it's 2.9, sometimes it's 3.1, but it's always around 3%. I have to say that when we identify the 3%, we actively remove the leadership layer because we want to get to the what is happening between employees. So, but you can also look at the leaders then and see, what is it in terms of the leadership team, right? So let's say we have a leadership team with 200 people. We typically see that it's about 5% that really shape the perceptions of all their colleagues. And I think one of the interesting things about those 3% is that you would think that you would know who those people are as an executive. But we have this little trick we've done now for 15 years where we say, so who do you think it is? And we actually allow people to note down names on who it is that they think it is. And to this date, nobody has guessed who their most influential employees are.
Wow, that's amazing.
And I think that is really amazing. Yeah, it is. It is amazing.
So how is people want to better understand who's most influential? And they bring you into the organization. What's the first thing you do?
The first thing we need to understand is, okay, what do you want to use them for? But that's a process thing, right? Because we need to identify them in the right way so it fits with the objective. When we know that part, we can tailor our diagnostic, we can run our data collection, and then we can deliver on the things that they would like us to deliver.
I'm actually trying to get to the bottom of how this really works. So do you do this through written surveys or you actually interview everyone?
No, so email surveys.
Oh, okay. Yep.
So, and it is very simple, right? So if I ask you who gives you energy in your daily work life, then you get a pre-populated list of people that you can point to, which is your colleagues, right? And you just go in and you write like Janet, J-A-N-E, and then when you find the right name, you just hit enter and then you're done.
So how do you know how to populate that list?
We get that data from the company.
Interesting.
We get the data and we get attributes so we can kind of, for example, if we want to look at inclusion, it's really nice if we know the gender. If we want to look at the leadership versus the employees, it's really nice if we can get the level of hierarchy that people are sitting in. If we want to know something about locations, then I would prefer to know what locations are they sitting in. What we need is determined by what the objective is.
And, you know, many organizations, of course, are really concerned right now, as you were just talking about, with diversity, equity, inclusion, and thinking about wellness and mental health. How could your process really help with that?
Well, this is a big question for me here. So let me just say, share one thing with you with, that we've seen over the pandemic. One of the things we've seen in the pandemic is where the networks inside organizations have become more fragmented. People are basically disconnected from each other as the pandemic endured. The networks are about 30% more fragmented than they were before. And what that really means is that you have less ties between people. That's one thing. So less ties, which means that you have less agility in the organization if you want to ask for help or knowledge sharing or whatever. That's an issue. But another issue is actually that it also makes people more lonely because some people actually have fallen out of the networks. It used to be that around 5% of the people were not sought out or indicated or pointed to when you were asked about who do you find sympathetic, competent, and trustworthy. And now it's about 15%. And in the worst case, it's 28% that we've seen that are not been identified by any of their colleagues. So just imagine that you're sitting here in this place, this lonely place where nobody is actually reaching out to you. Of course, you're part of the team meetings and maybe the corporate emails, but nobody's reaching out to you to just to talk to you. So you can see that in the networks, and the implication for mental well-being is just big. So that's one thing. The other thing is with inclusion. So when people are pointing to colleagues in this, and we then afterwards, we can add that attribute and say, okay, so are they pointing to a person of a different gender or a person of a different ethnicity or whatever, then we can start to see things. And we can see certain patterns. So for example, if I share with you a big US-based organization, we work with a pharma company. We looked at how they were connecting to each other, and we could see that at entry level, the women were really connecting a lot to each other, whereas the men were not really connecting to any colleagues when they got into the business, right? So at entry level. And then as they moved upwards, I think the men, they were more like oriented towards the top than the women, right? And you could just see that then at the top level, the men had created the same kind of old boys network that the women had at their entry level. And that's, of course, an issue, right? If you want to change the way that the two genders are working together, because there's no doubt that the better they work together, the better you are performing.
And what did you find? So the women had a network at the bottom of the organization, but then what happened as they proceeded through the... Well, I guess you're not looking at the same group of women. You're looking at two groups of women, right? The women closer to entry level and then women at the top.
Yeah, so we actually looked at all levels throughout the organization. And what we could see was that when they kind of broke the ceiling at the top right, they still had to kick in the door to kind of get connected to the men at the top, which is an issue, right? Because then the issue is still existing. One thing is you get to the top, but if you still do not have any interaction, then what's the value then, right? So you need to make sure you create those connections right up front.
Yeah, it's fascinating, though. I mean, that you could give a company that kind of path to really pursue.
Yeah. Let me give you another example that I shared with one of your colleagues, which is also pretty good. It's a biotech company. And what they wanted to do when they looked at the networks, what they wanted to add performance grading to it. So every single person had an attribute saying that either they were a high performer or a solid performer or a low performer, right? And then, of course, they also had a group of newcomers. And this interesting thing here was that all the high performers, they were connecting to each other. I mean, you want to be like together with people that are just like yourself. So that was not surprising. The solid performers, they were connecting to other solid performers and a bit to high performers because they were aspiring to be a high performer, right? That probably makes sense as well. The fun part in this one was that the newcomers, who they were connecting to, because they were connecting to the low performers. And I think this is actually probably happening in a lot of organizations because when they got into the organization, right, they didn't have any credibility at all in the organization. So who was ready to welcome them and talk to them? It was the low performers.
That's fascinating. And then you think about who's now modeling what what we do here.
But that's exactly the problem, right? So if you don't think about your onboarding process and how people are getting connected into the networks in the organization, then you might actually face that problem. And it's not a good one.
You know, I'm just thinking of all the different ways that this could be used. And, you know, at Gagan, we talk about six levers that we often look at in terms of change. And I think we've talked about this, you know, about You've got your values, the energy in the organization, behavior, symbols, systems, communication.
Yeah.
How could we use the 3% rule to really connect to that?
Yeah, that's a good question again. Yeah. So the way I see it, how you should work with your six levers of change, you just need to work with the 3%. Because what is really important is that they need to make sense of what is going on. And then they will speak on your behalf to all their colleagues. I normally say, so the first thing you need to do with the 3% is you need to listen to them. Listen, listen, listen. Because they know what is going on. And they know how their colleagues are feeling. When you've listened to them, you can start to have the conversation. So the dialogue going on. And if you're really good, you can kind of engage them in co-creating activities with you. They can collaborate with them, etc. And what you're doing in that process is you turn them into insiders. When they are becoming insiders, that is the perfect place for you for the 3%, because then they will speak on your behalf to their colleagues, right? And all the colleagues, they also try to make sense of what is going on. But what they do is that they listen to the people they trust the most in the organization, which is really their peers. It's those 3%.
Yeah, I think back to some of our most successful change efforts, and it's often bringing in people like that to make sure they really understand what we're trying to do. And also for us to learn that what we're trying to do may not be the right thing.
So we even build feedback mechanisms for the 3% as you progress, right? Because you might build this major plan for what you want to achieve, but it's really important that you can calibrate that plan as you move on, because they will know what is going out there in the organization. So you build a feedback mechanism where they can give you feedback. So we do that also with our good clients.
What have you seen as the most effective ways for companies to do that? Like, do they actually pull together a cohort and name it something? Or how do they really engage with the individuals?
They might name them. What we recommend is it's almost like a democracy. We say, who should be the voices of the company in question, right? That you should engage with. So we ask people for the help to identify who amongst their peers should be involved in this. That's how we kind of frame it. And then you can say what they do, as Lincoln said some time ago, to persuade with the underside, you send in someone they trust. And that's what you do with those people, right? You make sure that they actually get engaged to the extent they want or feel like it.
I was just thinking, as people are listening to this, and I'm sure finding it really interesting, once you have the 3%, what is the most effective way to use them? And do you actually identify them as a group?
We identify them as a group and as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
When it's a group, it's this voice of the company, right? But also as individuals, because you need to have a conversation going with them. If you drive your change through, it's important, as I said before, that you listen to them. And listening is hard to do if you do not communicate with them. So listen, listen, listen. That's, again, what I've said before. But you should keep that communication going, right? I mean, you need to keep that relationship because they have the influence. So you want to keep them happy also over time. And I think that is really important. You, at the same time, you don't want to overwhelm them. So there is a balance here, right? Because you don't want to, I'm not sure if you're familiar with that analogy, but right, in Europe, we say you don't want to take them out of the organization and give them a yellow shirt so now that everybody knows that they are the leader. Because the reason why they're so important is actually that they have the informal influence. And the same second you actually make them part of the formal organization, then they will lose their informal influence. So it's really important actually to keep this as informal as possible.
And do you ever get in a situation where you see other employees getting upset that they're not part of that group?
No. Again, if you have positioned it good, then it's like a democracy thing where you actually point it to your representatives in the change program. And I think that actually removes most of that fear that some could have. And everybody would know who they are. That's the other thing, right? Everybody knows one of those representatives, so they can actually talk to them if they want.
And in sort of on the other side of things, have you ever run into a situation where the 3%, anyone kind of resents being put in that position?
So what we sometimes do before we actually give the names to the client is that we then ask, can we share your name with our sponsor, basically, right? And again, in the last 15 years, we've only experienced 3 people saying no to that.
Wow.
In all 3 cases, and I know them all by heart, it was people moving on to a new job in a different company. If you look at it from the other side, right, if you have been identified as one of those people here, right, it's actually a pretty positive thing. Your colleagues are going to acknowledge you as a sympathetic person, a competent person, and a trustworthy person. I mean, who wouldn't like to be acknowledged like that? Maybe I should emphasize that. We're not saying that these are the top ones. We're saying that these are the group of people that collectively have the biggest impact. So we're not like trying to rank people versus each other.
I was thinking back to what you were talking about earlier about some of the research you did. And I know during COVID, as you just said, you'd found a number of people who are really disconnected and you called them the lost generation within companies.
Yes.
How are you thinking about that and what are you doing around that situation?
So the lost generation for us is the group of people that joined a new company from March 2020 and then 6 months forward, so about September 2020. Those people were facing onboarding practices that were not built for COVID, so they were not virtual, so at least not built for it, right? So what we could see or have been able to see is that they have been significantly less integrated into the company networks and a lot less integrated into the networks than the people that actually joined the company as from September 2020 and onwards. And it's still the case. The issue here is that when leaders look at that group of people, they see them as a 10-year group of people, right? They've been with the company almost 2 years or more than 2 years, right? So why would they even think about building their networks? And what we recommend here is really practically, we say, first, as a leader, make sure you show them that you see them. So this is about a one-on-one conversation here. Talk to them and tell them, okay, we know that this was a tough time when you got hired into our organization. And secondly, try to find out who is it that they should be connected to in the informal networks, because they haven't built up that experience of connecting to people while they were working in the office or whatever. So they don't have it. They need someone to help them build those informal networks.
That's interesting because, you know, there's a lot of media coverage out now that many people who join new companies during COVID are leaving. And, you know, I've heard numbers up to 40% of people are looking for new jobs. And I wonder if that's really at the root of a lot of it. It's interesting.
I think if you combine that thing that you just mentioned here with the loneliness of people not being reached out to,
right,
new people coming in that nobody connects to, I think you have a good reason for that at least. And it harms well-being, as we talked about before, mental well-being.
But that, I think, it actually gives companies a place to look as they're trying to understand what's happening and why they're losing people. I think that's a really interesting concept.
And I mean, you don't need to do a net organization network analysis to do this. You actually just go into your employee master data and you look at that group of people. I mean, we have proved it already. So I mean, for me, it's about most people. Most leaders should just know this, that they need to connect to those ones and see if they can help them. For nothing else, it's good for people. So just do it.
As people think about doing this kind of diagnostic, are there any watch-outs that they should consider or to be careful about?
Yes, I think there are a couple of watch-outs. First of all, I think you need to have an objective. We have seen some companies that just want to do this because they think it's a fun thing to do, kind of get a hold of how the network's looking. But I mean, your employees will hate you for it, right? They know that if you're not doing anything with it, it just creates this fatigue that you also know from engagement surveys. So you should only do this if you have something to use it for. I think that's really important. Another thing that I think is really important is that when you look at networks, people sometimes, again, they fall in love with networks. You have to understand that networks are different depending on what you are looking at. So the decision network, for example, in an organization is looking different than the influence network. The friendship network is also looking different than the innovation network. So you need to understand that how networks are really working. I've seen some companies that wants to run an email analysis of something, and then they have, and now I'm thinking about a US company as well, a US pharma company. They were looking at who was sending the most emails. And they found out that the people that were sending the most emails were also on the talent list. So they actually made the conclusion that just because they were sending the most emails, then they were also the right talents. And nothing could be further from the truth, right? So what we actually see sometimes is that those people that you can identify through as really active on digital communication channels, they are totally invisible in the informal networks. And again, if you just think about, okay, so if you want to ask a trusted person for help and advice, what's the first thing you do? Is the first thing you do sending an email, or is the first thing that you actually call that person? Or maybe even better, you find the person, you ask the person face to face how they can help you. And I think it's obvious to everyone, we're not sending emails when we really want to have a qualified, competent answer. So you cannot really use the digital channels for this.
That's interesting. And you talked about making sure you really know what you want to use the network for. Why don't you give us some examples of the ways that network analysis is most effective? Like, what kind of question might I have, or problem I want to solve, or opportunity I want to grab on that I'd say, wow, this would be great to know the network?
One of the things we see is often in relationship, and I'm giving you examples now, right? One example is with mergers and acquisitions, or I should say after acquisitions, if you want to integrate two companies together. The first thing that always happens is that people, when they get acquired by an outsider, there's nothing that can kind of make people stick together as being acquired, right?
Right. Yeah, we see that a lot.
So you get acquired, you kind of make sure, okay, from now on, I'm only going to eat lunch with all the people that I was working with before, and every single time you pass by them in the hallway, you kind of nod to each other and you know, okay, we're the secret crowd here from this acquired company. Those networks, we can see those in organizations 10 years later, but where they're still like tightly knit networks that we cannot explain with anything else than they have been acquired. Not because they're sitting in the same team or whatever. And network analysis can illuminate those networks, and it can find ways for you to dissolve them by making sure you find individuals that are really connected inside and then connect them with individuals from the other company. And typically what we say is if you give them a task where they can work together on, and where they can have a bit of social time and a bit of fun, because there's nothing that connects as having fun together, then over time they will build those connections. It doesn't go like this, because relationships and networks are pretty sticky, but it will happen. One of our partners is actually a capital fund. So what they do is that they go in and they acquire companies. They carve out a part of the organization, and then after 1 or 2 months, when they've kind of fixed the first initial things they wanted to fix in the leadership team, we do the first assessment. And then we find out, okay, who should be retained, or who is it that they really need to focus on retaining as, because there's going to be a lot of fluctuation. And we have certain experts that we really want to retain, and or people that provide value, right? So that's one group. But we also want to retain or make sure we identify who has the influence. It's not the same group of people. So we identify those people, and then they work with them over time, and we reassess and we track what is happening. And we do that over a 4 to 5 year period, right? Because that's where they try to make the most value out of their acquisitions, and then they sell it off again. And when they sell it off, they can actually tell the acquirer how the company is actually integrated. They can tell them who is that you really need to integrate, or not integrate, but retain in that process when we are going through the sell-off. And I think that is, in my view, at least one of the places where this has an extreme value. But it's about getting the right people together. What we see a lot of companies are doing is that they look at the leadership team and put them together in the group, right, in the room, but that doesn't connect the people. So that's one thing, or one way. Another way is actually using it for leadership groups. So if you have a leadership group of 250 people that are meeting for an annual seminar, people get to the seminar, they look around when they get into the big room and try to find people that they have good friendships with or they know from the past, right? And then they move over to those people and talk to each other. We actually go in and look at, so how are these leadership networks connected to each other? And then we force groupings in. We connect people together that are not connected to each other, or people that have pointed to each other for effectiveness potential. One of the key questions we ask in leadership groups is, who could make you more effective if you could collaborate more with that individual? And I don't know why, but in leadership groups, that's one of those groups where we have the most silos that we see that you can expect. I mean, that no other groups have as many silos as leadership groups. And they have all kinds of excuses for not connecting to each other. And very often the solution for connecting people is so simple that you just tell them you have both pointed to each other for effectiveness potential. You now go out of the room and you have 5 minutes to find out how do you work on this tomorrow. And then you report back to us. It's such a quick fix that you cannot imagine. It's just amazing when that happens.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like a quick intervention.
It is. I mean, what I can best compare this leadership intervention that we do with is actually with a wedding planner, right? We just use it in the opposite way. When you plan for a wedding, you put people together at the tables that you would like to have a good time so they could be seated together. We do the opposite. We put people together at the tables that don't know each other, don't want to talk to each other, and then we give them tasks so they get connected.
As you're thinking about this, are there ways that leaders then need to behave differently as they learn about these organizations?
It depends on the leader, of course. And I think I can normally group leaders into two categories, the ones that already do this and then the ones that have a small challenge with it. But I think the first thing you need to do as a leader is you need to be open to that you do not know everything. You do not know it all. And certainly you do not know how your employees are connected to each other. If you as a leader are humble enough to say, I don't know everything, I'm not that arrogant, then you're already on a good journey. So understanding that rather than just think you know, you should actually ask your people, who is it that they trust? Who is it they connect to? Who is it that could make them more effective? Who is it that they, this is another good question, who is it that they would go to stretch their thinking? Which is typically a totally different breed of people than what we normally see in organizations.
Stretching your thinking makes me think of innovation. And I know there's been a lot of talk as of late as to whether companies' innovation is being really hampered by remote work.
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
I think it is. And I think it requires a good effort to make sure that people connect to each other. Again, I think the informal networks could be the answer. I just shared something on my LinkedIn profile here today about a pharma company we work with, another pharma company. It's not the same. I'm actually different pharma companies I've been talking about, but this is another pharma company. In a group of 2,200 people, we identified who were the most creative and innovative people. And none of them had the innovation in their title. None of them were really recognized by anyone else, right? But it was the people that people were going to stretch their thinking. An important group of people, right? And these people, they were not connected to each other, so they didn't even know each other as well. And what this pharma company did, and you can of course look it up on my profile, but I mean, what they really did was that they connected these 45 people into one 30-minute setting. And in that 30-minute setting, they uncovered everything that happened at grassroots level in the organization, something they said would otherwise have taken them 2 years to uncover. They uncovered by talking to the grassroots. And then I think that is insane. And it's a really, really fantastic story about how you can actually fuel innovation if you circumvene the informal or the formal structures.
Yeah, talk to the people closest to the work.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's terrific. What else should I be asking you?
Well, that's a good question. You could ask me about my favorite project. It's one of my first projects, and I think actually because we didn't really talk about that, it was a change program. So with a major wind turbine producer, and I'm just giving you the story here. So the story is that the person that was identified as the most influential person in the organization, it was an energy company. The person that had the most influence was not someone that the people higher up, they actually knew, or they knew it was a really new person. It was a person who had only been there for 4 months. And they said, how could that person be the most influential person? So together with the HR director, we actually researched what made that person influential. First of all, he had his nationality against him. He was a Frenchman. And I don't know how you feel about that, but in Denmark, we often have this thing about Frenchmen. They're pretty arrogant. We don't want to really to have anything to do with them. I actually like French people, so I'm not personally, I like them. But we have this thinking about them, right? It was a Frenchman. He had only been there 4 months, and somehow he had created a network, so he was the most influential person. But we looked at what he was doing. What he was doing was that he traveled between the different locations they had. And they were not far apart. It was like 2 hours or 3 hours apart. So he was kind of commuting back and forth all the time, right? But when the meetings were over, everybody else jumped out in their cars or took the train, and then they went back to their home office. What he did was that he always stayed behind and socialized with people, asked people how they were doing. And I mean, within 4 months, people knew that, okay, this guy is actually really, really sympathetic. But he's not only sympathetic, he's actually also competent. He actually knew stuff, so they could ask him questions. I mean, 4 months and being the most influential person, what does that tell you? It tells you at least that that influence does have nothing to do with how many years you've been in the organization. So tenure is not a characteristic of a really influential person. What is more maybe a characteristic of an influential person is that they tend to be a bit more introverted than what we expect. And maybe there's a reason for that, because I think if you want to ask a person for help, who would you go to ask for help? You probably go to a person that actually reflects on what you're actually asking for, then reflects and reflects, and then come back with an answer, rather than a person that just waits until you pause a single second, and then they give their answer, right? So I think that is one of the secrets that we really should be aware of. It's a different breed of people.
I think that's a great add to this conversation, you know, to really think about the introverts.
Yeah.
And of course, even in your story, you point out that introverts aren't as obvious as you think either, because here's a person who's socializing with everybody, yeah, but exactly, is an introvert. Right.
You know, the fun thing is that we met the same Frenchman some years later, and I was explaining, and this was in another energy company, I was explaining the case to our sponsor we were kind of pitching to. And then I was telling them about this Frenchman, and then she said, I think that Frenchman is now working in our company, because there's a person that has just joined and the person is doing the exact same thing. And it was the same person. So
it was? Wow.
So that person apparently had a habit of doing that when he joined a new company. And it's a good practice. We didn't even talk about what I call the early adopters. But sometimes you can actually say, so if we are now implementing some kind of major change, who would be the first ones to adopt this change? And you can ask people those questions. They know who amongst their colleagues would be the first ones to adopt it. And those people you really want to engage, but here they love being engaged, right? Because it's people that love to play with things, so they like to try out new things. So it actually, again, depends on what type of personality are you looking at. But yes, in general, I think it's really important to respect the networks of people.
I would imagine one case where the networks could be really incredibly helpful is in a strategy shift. And as a company's thinking about going in a new direction or transforming the organization, really getting that 3% on board and understanding what we're trying to do and what it'll take to get there, and to help the leaders understand what it's really going to take to get there.
So we've seen that often in strategy and culture shifts. Actually, right from the start where you do stuff, make sure they're with you, where they're part of the sessions almost, where you define it, because they might know the culture better than you do as a leader, right? So get them into that session and then use them as your advocates as you roll it out to the organization. We have a company we're working with in Houston. They've been really successful with doing that. It's a company with about 500 people. And I mean, the way they engage they call them change ambassadors. That's the word they use, right? The way they engaged the change ambassadors in changing the culture was just magnificent.
Yeah, we've found that often, that that's a really effective use. But what's interesting about this is how you find them in the first place.
Exactly. That's also the hard part.
And that's what you bring to the table, which is terrific. Are there certain things you think leaders really need to let go of?
I think leaders really need to let go of that they think they know everything, right? They should trust their people. I mean, in my view, people are marvelous and they can do marvelous things if you just let them. And I think that's really a key learning for me. You need to let go of the control gene that you might have. Make sure that people can get to work. Most people really want to do brilliant work and will do whatever they can to succeed. I think that is that's also what you see in the networks. The networks that are really, really great, information is just fluid. The networks are fluid. People are connecting to each other. They are solving issues very, very fast. You can actually measure the agility of this happening. And the good companies, they are just really, really good at this. And the good leaders are really good at empowering people to do this.
Yeah, we see that a lot too, in that the most agile organizations are the ones where the communication is not just going down and up the organization, but it's all across the organization.
Exactly. It's all over.
And that's really how things move quickly, right?
Yeah, no, but I mean, from a metric point of view, you can measure this as the distance between everyone in the organization. And naturally, you want to decrease the distance between your people in the organization, in the informal networks. And what is distance? So let's say you have two teams here, right? So you have team one and team two, right? So if there's a person over here who wants to ask his leader for help or her leader for help, then they have to go up. That's a distance of one. They have to go across to the other leader. That's a distance of two. And they have to go down, which is a distance of three. So rather than having a distance of three where you kind of follow the formal structures, the best thing you can do is just to have a direct communication, right? Then you're down to one. And that's the way you optimize networks. And you can actually optimize, but you need to connect the right people to each other. And the other thing I should say is that you don't want all people to connect to each other. There's a lot of talk about, okay, we all need to collaborate, right? But we shouldn't. We only should collaborate with the ones where it makes sense. And there's a certain bandwidth we can actually have in our brain for building connections and networks. It's about 150 people we can have networks to. So make sure you spend your network on the right people. And I think that's where the leadership challenge actually is for the future, making sure that you tell your people who is it that should connect to each other, where is it that it makes sense, where is the value, and then leave them to themselves so they can create the value.
That's an interesting thing too, because of course there's, you know, the whole theory of really be mindful of who you surround yourself with.
Yes.
So Jeppe, thank you so much for joining us today. This was absolutely fabulous to hear all about what you're doing with the organizational network analysis.
Thank you. It was a pleasure being with you.
Those were very powerful learnings from Jeppe on organizational network analysis. Let's recap a few learnings. Organizational network analysis can show to whom people reach out if they want to innovate, who are the people they trust, and who has influence in the organization, as well as who makes decisions. It was also fascinating to learn how Jeppe determined the maximum impact of a change initiative using organizational network analysis. His experience over the past 15 years shows it's always around 3% of the people that shape commitment and perceptions of about 90% of their colleagues. And what's incredible is that to this day, no leaders have accurately guessed who were the most influential employees in their organization. Finally, Jeppe believes that leaders need to let go of thinking they know everything. He shared how understanding networks can be a powerful influence and resource for leaders. By enabling people to connect with one another, they can solve issues more quickly. I really found Jeppe and his work in organizational network analysis very powerful in this Let Go and Lead episode. Thank you for joining us.